All right, so let's dive into something that, well, might sound a little bit dry at first glance. Austerity. Stick with us though, because this isn't just about like numbers and budgets, you know. This is about real world choices, real world consequences that really honestly touch all of our lives.
Yeah, absolutely.
We're gonna unpack why governments choose austerity, what it actually looks like in action. And the ripple effects, you know, the consequences it creates. Think Greece on the brink of leaving the euro. UK facing some, well, pretty serious criticism from the UN, actually. And the, well, the surprising truth about all those like necessary cuts we keep hearing about. Ready to kind of get your economics geek on.
I'm always ready. And you're right, austerity, it's a word that gets thrown around a lot. People, I don't think, always have a really clear understanding of what it really entails, you know? At its core, it's a set of government policies, right? Designed to shrink budget deficits. Basically, the gap between what a government spends and what it takes in through taxes. And these policies, well, they can include straight up budget cuts across various sectors. I'm talking education, welfare, healthcare, even defense, as well as tax hikes, and sometimes even, you know, privatization of state-owned assets.
So, okay, so it's not just some abstract economic theory.
No.
This is like real cuts to essential services, the kind of things that affect people's daily lives. Didn't the UK see like a huge rise in the use of food banks
Yeah.
as a result of austerity measures?
Exactly. The Trussell Trust, they're a UK charity that runs a network of food banks. They reported distributing, get this, over 2.1 million food parcels just in 2022, 2023. That's a staggering increase from just over 61,000 a decade earlier. And this, well, this stark reality underscores the human cost of austerity, which it goes far beyond, you know, numbers on a balance sheet. It's not just food banks either. Think about, you know, the teachers. We've seen their real incomes decline by, I mean, a significant percentage since 2010. And that's led to, you know, teacher shortages and a real strain on the quality of education. Even the justice system, not spared. Cuts have led to smaller police forces and court closures.
So, like, the impacts are really widespread.
They are.
And they hit those who are, I mean, already struggling the hardest.
Absolutely.
But why would a government choose this path?
Yeah.
Knowing the potential consequences, is it really just about, I mean, like balancing the books, like we hear in the news?
Well, balancing the books, yeah, that's part of it, sure. But the rationale behind austerity, I think, runs a bit deeper. One of the key arguments is the perceived danger of high national debt. Think of it this way. If a country keeps borrowing and borrowing and borrowing, you know, it could eventually become so indebted that it can't even pay the interest on its loans, let alone the principal, right? This can lead to a real loss of confidence in the country's economy, you know, and that could potentially trigger a full-blown financial crisis.
That makes sense. Nobody wants to be that person, right? Maxing out all their credit cards, drowning in debt. But why? Why the sudden urgency to like slash spending in recent years? Was it sparked by something specific?
Yeah, the urgency definitely ramped up after the 2008 financial crisis, I think. Remember those massive government bailouts of the banks? Those bailouts, I mean, they were necessary, you know, to prevent a complete financial meltdown, but they added significantly to national debts across the globe, and that fueled fears of a sovereign debt crisis.
So governments were kind of like spooked, you know,
I think so, yeah.
into thinking that they needed to tighten their belts fast.
Yeah.
But if we're talking about debt, isn't there also this idea of not burdening future generations?
Yeah, that's a great point. That's the concept of intergenerational equity. It's the argument that the current generation shouldn't be, you know, racking up huge debts that our children and grandchildren will have to pay off later. Imagine inheriting a mountain of debt. Not exactly a fun welcome to adulthood, right?
No, definitely not. So it seems like this fear of debt and a desire to be responsible for future generations were kind of like driving forces behind this push for austerity. And what's really fascinating is that at least initially, the public seemed to be on board with this idea, right?
Yeah, that's what makes this even more complex.
Yeah.
In the UK, for example, public opinion polls back in the early 2010s showed a surprising level of support for austerity measures.
Yeah.
People seemed to understand, you know, the need for shared sacrifice after the financial crisis.
Yeah.
And there was a sense that everyone needed to tighten their belts.
So it wasn't just, I mean, politicians pushing this agenda.
Right.
There was like a genuine belief, you know, among many people that these cuts were necessary.
Yeah, yeah.
But how did this play out, you know? How did this play out in the real world? Can you give us some like concrete examples of what austerity actually looked like?
Absolutely. Let's start with Greece, which, I mean, they became kind of a poster child for the potential downsides of austerity. Remember that? I mean, that nail-biting moment in 2015 when they were on the verge of exiting the Eurozone.
Yeah.
Potentially triggering a domino effect.
Yeah.
Across the entire European economy.
Yeah, I remember that. It felt like the whole world was watching, holding its breath.
Yeah.
But what led Greece to that, I mean, to that brink of collapse in the first place?
Well, after Greece adopted the euro back in 2001, they enjoyed this period of relatively low interest rates,
okay,
which encouraged borrowing.
Huh.
However, this led to years of excessive spending, you know, and ballooning deficits.
Yeah.
Essentially, they built up a mountain of debt that became unsustainable, frankly, when the financial crisis hit.
So they were living beyond their means.
Yeah.
And when the economic tides turned, they were caught in a rip current.
That's a great analogy.
Right.
And the consequences were severe. Greece was forced to accept a bailout package from the European Union and the IMF.
Yeah.
But that, you know, that came with some really stringent austerity measures.
Right.
We're talking about massive cuts to public spending, tax hikes, and a whole lot of, you know, pain for the Greek people.
That sounds incredibly tough. What did these austerity measures look like in everyday life for the Greek people?
Well, I mean, it was a period of profound hardship. Unemployment skyrocketed, wages plummeted, and essential services like healthcare and education, well, they were stretched thin. You know,
yeah.
It was a stark reminder that, you know, while austerity might be intended to stabilize an economy, it can come with a pretty hefty social cost.
So Greece provides a cautionary tale of what can happen when austerity measures are implemented too harshly or without like sufficient support.
Yeah.
But let's shift gears a little bit. Bring this back to the UK. You mentioned earlier that the UK, they chose austerity. So what was the driving force behind that decision?
Well, in 2010, the Conservative Liberal Democrat coalition government, they came into power with a really strong belief in the necessity of austerity. They argued that the UK's deficit was, you know, completely out of control.
Right.
And that drastic measures were needed to kind of restore economic stability.
So unlike Greece, which was, I mean, essentially forced into austerity, the UK government, they actively embraced it.
Yeah.
as a core principle.
Absolutely.
And just like in Greece, these cuts had, you know, a ripple effect across various sectors of British society, right?
Mm-hmm. Exactly. And this is where things get, you know, particularly interesting, because there's been a growing debate about, you know, whether the UK's approach to austerity was truly necessary, you know, or if it went too far.
Right.
In fact, a UN report was highly critical of the UK's austerity program.
Okay, let's talk about that UN report.
Yeah.
It sounds like they didn't, you know, mince words.
No, they didn't.
What were their main criticisms?
Well, the report was, I mean, scathing, to say the least. They called the UK's austerity policies punitive, mean-spirited, and often callous, you know?
Yeah.
Arguing that they inflicted great misery on the population, particularly on the most vulnerable. They highlighted the alarming rise in child poverty, stating that it was not just a disgrace, but a social calamity and an economic disaster, you know, for one of the world's wealthiest nations.
Wow, those are strong words coming from the UN. It seems like they were like deeply concerned about the impact of austerity on the UK. What specific like examples did the report cite to kind of back up these claims?
The report it delved into various sectors, you know, where austerity's impact was particularly harsh.
Okay.
Education, for example, they pointed to funding cuts that led to teacher shortages, forcing schools to rely more and more on less experienced, you know, supply teachers, which, well, inevitably impacts the quality of education,
yeah,
especially for students from, you know, disadvantaged backgrounds.
That's a real domino effect, right?
Yeah.
Cuts in one area leading to this, I don't know, cascade of consequences in others. What about the welfare system? The report mentioned food banks, but did it go into, you know, detail about the specific welfare cuts that kind of drove people to rely on those services?
Absolutely. The report highlighted deep cuts to Social Security benefits.
Right.
Particularly for those with disabilities and families with children. And these, you know, these cuts, they made it so difficult for people to make ends meet.
Yeah.
Forcing so many to turn to food banks, just to put food on the table.
Right.
Imagine being a parent and not being able to afford to feed your children. You know, that's the reality that many families in the UK face because of these austerity measures.
That's heartbreaking to think about.
Mm-hmm.
It seems like the UN report was really trying to, you know, shine a light on the human cost of these policies.
Yeah.
The stories behind the statistics. Did they address the justice system as well? I remember you mentioned police and court closures earlier.
Yes, the justice system wasn't spared either. The report cited significant reductions in police funding,
right,
leading to fewer officers on the streets, you know, and kind of a perceived decline in public safety. Court closures also meant longer waiting times for trials, which, I mean, could potentially delay justice for both victims and the accused. You know, it paints a picture of a system struggling to cope with the strain imposed by these cuts.
So the UN report essentially argued that the UK's austerity program, it went too far,
mm-hmm,
inflicting like unnecessary hardship on its citizens, especially, you know, the most vulnerable.
Absolutely.
But wasn't austerity supposed to be like a temporary measure?
Yeah.
To get the economy back on track? What was the UN's perspective on that?
Well, the report, it kind of challenged that whole notion.
Okay.
That austerity was a short-term fix.
Right.
They argued that the depth and the duration of the cuts in the UK, they were excessive.
Okay.
And really disproportionate to the economic challenges the country faced. The report also expressed concern that these policies, I mean, they might have actually violated UN human rights agreements.
Oh, wow.
Particularly in their impact on the rights to an adequate standard of living, education, and social security.
That's a pretty damning assessment.
It seems like the UN was, I don't know, like saying that the UK government, they prioritized deficit reduction, you know, over,
yep,
over the well-being of its citizens.
Yeah.
But it's interesting, right? Because at the time, austerity was presented as like the only responsible option.
Yeah.
Was there any, you know, alternative approach like being discussed back then?
Yeah, there were definitely, you know, alternative viewpoints, although they weren't as prominent, you know, in the mainstream discourse at the time. Remember how we talked about those super low interest rates,
yeah,
after the 2008 financial crisis? Well, some economists, they argued that those low rates, they actually created a unique opportunity, you know, for governments to borrow cheaply,
right,
and to invest in growth stimulating initiatives. Hold on. Help me wrap my head around this.
Yeah.
So instead of like cutting back during a time of economic hardship, the argument was that governments should have been spending more.
Yeah.
How does that make sense?
I know it might seem counterintuitive, but think of it this way. When interest rates are low, borrowing is cheap.
Okay.
So instead of slashing spending, governments, you know, they could have used that borrowed money to invest in infrastructure projects, education, renewable energy, essentially anything that would boost economic activity and create jobs.
So it's kind of like taking out a loan to invest in a business venture, hoping that the investment will eventually, I don't know, generate enough returns to pay off the loan and then some.
That's a great analogy. Yeah. The idea is that by investing in things that stimulate economic growth, you create a more, you know, robust economy.
Right.
That generates more tax revenue in the long run. That increased revenue, well, then it can be used to, you know, pay down the debt over time.
So it sounds like a longer term strategy, right? Mm-hmm. Focusing on building a stronger, I don't know, like a foundation.
Yeah.
Rather than just like patching up the cracks.
Exactly.
Did this alternative view gain any traction at the time? Were any prominent institutions or economists advocating for this approach?
Well, while this perspective wasn't, I mean, it wasn't as widely embraced as austerity, it did have its proponents.
Okay.
And interestingly, even the IMF, an institution known for advocating fiscal discipline, later acknowledged that they had, well, underestimated the damaging effects of austerity.
Wait, really? The IMF, the champion of austerity,
Yeah.
admitted they got it wrong.
Mm-hmm.
That's, I mean, that's a pretty big deal. What led them to change their stance?
Well, I mean, as more data became available, it became increasingly clear that austerity, particularly when it's implemented too aggressively or for too long, it could actually hinder economic recovery. And this realization, coupled with the growing social costs of austerity, well, it prompted the IMF to reevaluate its position. And in 2016, in a report, they openly acknowledged that they had underestimated the negative impact of austerity on economic growth and employment.
That's a significant admission.
It is.
Does this suggest that international institutions like the IMF may have been, too quick to prescribe austerity measures?
Yeah.
Without fully considering the potential consequences?
Yeah, it certainly raises questions about, whether a one-size-fits-all approach to economic policy is really appropriate. What might work in one country, might not necessarily be the best solution for another.
Right.
And it highlights the need for a more, nuanced understanding of each country's unique circumstances and challenges.
So context matters.
It does.
And it seems like the conversation around austerity has become, I don't know, like more nuanced as well.
Yeah.
We've gone from a time when it was seen as like the only responsible option to a situation where it's being seriously questioned, both in terms of its, effectiveness and its ethical implications. It's quite a shift in perspective.
Yeah, it really highlights, it highlights the fact that economics, it isn't just about like numbers and equations.
Right.
It's about, people's lives, their choices and the consequences of those choices. So as we kind of wrap up our deep dive into austerity, what are the key takeaways? What should we be mulling over?
Well, I think we've gotten a much clearer understanding of, of what austerity is. Those policies, they're designed to reduce budget deficits, often through spending cuts and tax increases. We've also, we've explored the rationale behind it.
Yeah.
The desire to, reduce national debt, control inflation, avoid, passing on a heavy burden to future generations.
And we've seen how those theories, they play out, in the real world with the contrasting examples of Greece and the UK.
Yeah.
Greece, I mean, they were forced into austerity.
Yeah.
As a condition of their bailout, right?
Mm-hmm.
Faced severe economic hardship and social unrest. The UK, on the other hand, they chose austerity.
Right.
Driven by, a particular ideological perspective.
Yeah.
And while the economic impacts, they were less severe, there were still significant social costs.
Yeah.
As highlighted by that UN report we talked about.
Yeah. I think what's particularly striking is how the conversation around austerity, it's evolved.
Yeah.
The whole idea that, that it's the only responsible approach to economic challenges. Well, that's being challenged now.
Okay.
And the notion of borrowing to invest in growth. Well, that's gaining some traction, especially in light of, historically low interest rates.
So if austerity isn't always the answer, what is? What are some alternative approaches to kind of like navigating these, these economic challenges, especially in a world that seems, increasingly volatile and unpredictable?
That's the million-dollar question. And unfortunately, there's no, simple one-size-fits-all answer.
Right.
But this deep dive, I mean, I think it's given us some valuable insights.
Yeah.
It's highlighted the importance of considering the long-term impacts of economic policies, not just focusing on short-term gains. It's also, it's underscored the need for a more nuanced understanding of debt and deficits.
Right.
Recognizing that not all debt is bad, and that strategic investments can lead to long-term growth and prosperity.
And perhaps most importantly, it's reminded us that economics is ultimately about people.
You know, policies, they're not just like abstract numbers on a balance sheet. They have, you know, real world consequences that affect, you know, people's lives, their well-being, their opportunities.
Absolutely. I think we can't lose sight of the human dimension of economics. You know, it's not just about GDP growth and deficit reduction. It's about creating a society where everyone has, you know, has a chance to thrive. And that requires thoughtful, well-informed policies that consider both, you know, the economic and the social impact.
So listeners, you know, as we wrap up our exploration of austerity, here's a thought-provoking question to kind of like ponder.
Okay.
If austerity isn't always, you know, the answer, what are the alternative approaches that we should be, you know, exploring?
Yeah.
And how can we ensure that economic policies, you know, they're designed not just for stability and growth, but also for fairness and opportunity for all?
That's a great question to kind of leave our listeners with. You know, it encourages them to think critically about these, you know, these complex issues and to engage in the ongoing debate about how we shape a more, you know, a more just and an equitable economic future.
The conversation about austerity and about economic policy in general, you know, it's far from over.
Yeah.
And understanding the nuances of these issues is crucial, you know, for all of us. So keep learning, keep questioning, and keep pushing for a better economic future. Until next time on The Deep Dive.